Hello, it is December 28th, 2015. You are looking live at New York, New York. This is episode 541 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am your aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. Sorry, we didn't do a podcast last week. I wanted to get one more with Allison Footer, but it's the holidays. Hope you all had a wonderful holiday. Oh, unless your holiday is just starting. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Boxing Day. It's post-Boxing Day. Boxing Day is not longer than a day. It's a Boxing Day. It's not a Boxing Week. So I hope you enjoyed your Boxing Day. Hope you enjoyed your holidays. I am in New York doing television stuff for Bloomberg Politics. Their show is moving. The show that I am on, with all due respect, is moving to MSNBC. It's staying on Bloomberg, but it's moving to MSNBC in January. And I am filming some segments to be on the first week of shows on MSNBC. Think of me as their Jeanne Moos. Remember her from CNN? She's still on CNN, but she's the correspondent for CNN. She's funnier than I am and smarter than I am, but that's the kind of segments I'll be doing for them. So I'm out there doing that all day today and then heading back to Athens for the new year. But I am elated to have our annual Thanksgiving guest is Jeb Lund. Our annual New Year's holidays guest is Tommy Craig. Tommy is always one of my good friends who has had a tumultuous year. We'll put it that way. So he has plenty to say. You know, for those who did not know, Tommy Craigs was, of course, the third editor of Deadspin, and after that, he was the editorial director of Gawker Media before a rather high-profile blow-up in July. Tommy has not actually spoken about the details. I mean, he has spoken about it, but not in a public fashion. He's told me about it. He's told some friends. But he's not actually spoken about that in a public fashion since all that went down. So we get into that. I would have had Tommy on no matter what. I will have Tommy on forever if Tommy is a dog catcher in 25 years. I don't know if there will even be dog catchers in 25 years. In 25 years, the dogs will be catching us because dogs will be the new leaders of humanity. They'll be robot dogs. I may be off topic. The point is, Tommy is one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life and a fascinating person to talk to, whether you agree or whether you disagree with some of the decisions he's made or whether you even like Gawker Media or anything at all. I think Tommy is worth listening to on a lot of different topics, and certainly there's a lot of intrigue about how all that went down. This will be the time to get to listen to it. This is the last podcast of 2015 for the Will Leach Experience. We'll be back next week. I will be at the national championship game in Phoenix. We'll do something there probably with Matt Brown from Sports on Earth, who is also there. Then I will be in Iowa for the caucuses and then off to the Super Bowl in Santa Clara, hopefully to watch the Arizona Cardinals. But we will talk about that then too. Mostly, thank you for listening to the podcast this year. Please subscribe on iTunes and give us a nice review. It's always helpful when that happens. I don't know why it's helpful. People just tell me it's helpful, but I guess it is. I'm sure you've already fast-forwarded 15 seconds several times during this intro. So let's just get to Tommy. Here is Tommy Craigs. Have a wonderful new year. All right, Tommy, this is our third year of doing our New Year's end of year holiday podcast. Every year I talk to you, something big has just happened. Your year is entirely different than it was the year before. Last year, because I am inherently a lousy reporter, I got the news out of you that Tim Marchman was taking over Deadspin and then completely forgot. I guess I'm not a bad reporter. I'm a bad promoter of reporting.
Right.
I mentioned in the – I got out of you that Tim Marchman was taking over Deadspin and then forgot to promote it that way. And I was like, oh, here's Tommy. We just talked about some things. it's been a while. First off, thank you for coming on and continuing the tradition. Yes. I would have been very sad if you would have not come on.
Thank you.
You've had a tumultuous year.
Yeah, I have. Now I guess I'm just some unemployed guy on a podcast.
First off, I think that's 75% of podcasts already. So don't get too special. I don't know how much you want to get into it. I've talked to you about this privately, and you've even had talked about this in somewhat of a public realm, but not something that was public to the internet in a lot of ways. So I'm not going to push you on a lot of this stuff, but I'm a reporter. Damn it, it's what I do. So I'm going to ask you a few questions about this stuff, and I'm more curious your opinions. Now, how it all went down, because for those of you that do not know, have you given an interview since? I'm curious. Am I getting an accidental scoop again or not? Or am I like the fifth person? I'm just not paying enough attention.
I guess. Yeah. I mean that conference.
Yeah.
The Big Valley. Yeah. Aside from that, this will be the first time I've talked about it.
All right. Well, then I actually don't have any questions. So thank you for coming on. This is a great time. Let's talk Illini basketball for the next 45 minutes. That actually might be more depressing. All right. So let's go through it. So I think a lot of things that got confused around the time, there's some confusion about the timeline. So if you don't mind, can you walk me through, for those of you that do not remember, if you're listening to this podcast, you're wondering, who is this unemployed person on the podcast with Will? And why is, of course, you know who Tommy is. Tommy, of course, was the editorial director of Gawker Media until what month was it? When did that happen?
July.
Until July of this year, and then a shitstorm went down. I want to find out what happened and how you're doing in the wake of it. I know how you're doing in the wake because I talk to you all the time. But we're going to let our listeners know, or the listener-er. So my first question is, did you know when you were editing the now somewhat infamous story that did you know you had a corker on your hands, or did you think a lot about it at the time?
What do you mean by corker?
Did you think it was going to did you think it was going to be a big hit, and B, did you think it was going to be a big controversy or not?
Neither. This actually felt like sort of a routine bit of scuzzy gossip. Very much in the tradition of Gawker and Deadspin. Worked on plenty of stories like this, in a lot of ways scuzzier than this one. And for the people who don't know, I mean, since there's now no longer anything to actually reference on the internet beyond the reaction, it was a story about the CFO of Condé Nast, which was once upon a time a powerful media company that Gawker covered mercilessly. Mm-hmm. And this guy, his name is David Geithner. He happens to be the brother of Tim Geithner, former Treasury Secretary. David Geithner tried to procure an escort for a remote assignation, and this turned into a bit of a farce. He happened to pick maybe the worst possible escort. The guy was internet savvy enough to do some reverse image searches, and he figured out that this was David Geithner, and then he figured out this was Tim Geithner's brother, and this escort also happened to have a case before HUD regarding his he was evicted from an apartment, and so he tried to prevail upon his would-be client to help him out with his HUD case using his connections with the Obama administration.
But this was kind of a diluted notion in the first place, right?
Yeah. So this was – the story was published in – I don't have the exact date, but it was on a Thursday in July. It went up in the evening, and like – I knew it was controversial. I knew it was controversial enough to warrant me like having a fairly hands-on role with the edit, which most Gawker stories and most stories in general, I would, unless there was some pressing reason for me to look at it, they would go up, without much consultation from me. But this, I knew it was dicey enough that I should look at it and edit it. But I really didn't expect the response. There were elements to the story that I sort of took for granted. People would know where we were coming from. The thing that really blew up in our faces was the outing element of it. The escort is a man, a porn star, and obviously David Geithner is a man. He is married with kids. And I guess
there was a school of thought that said the headline to the story should have been private man, private executive poorly blackmailed by man on internet.
Well, this is an important thing. There was no blackmail or extortion. Okay. And this is like one of these things. The way the story is talked about now, everybody refers to it to the extent they refer to it at all as this extortion attempt. There was no extortion. the escort was just pissed off that he couldn't get his HUD case taken care of, and so he immediately came to Gawker. There was no moment where he said to Geithner, you know, if he doesn't get his way, he's going to take this to the press. There was no extortion. And that's an important point. I think it felt enough like an extortion. It felt strange enough. It felt like, that was the only way for people to make sense of what the escort was up to. But there were, and partly that was on us. I think there was not enough distance between our story and the escort. Again, I thought people would sort of understand that we were holding the escort, who was our source on this, sort of at arm's length. But I think people thought that we were in league with the escort to extort money out of Geithner, which wasn't true at all. The outing component of it was not, you know, and this is totally my failing. It did not even register as the problematic part of that story, or a potentially problematic part of that story. I assume people would know where Gawker was coming from, that Gawker is, essentially a gay website. That the idea of outing someone, I mean, people referred to the story as this homophobic smear job, and referred to me and the editor of Gawker as, you know, homophobes, and that as if this our intention were to, shame Geithner for being a closeted homosexual, which, you know, this is my blind spot. I thought people would know where Gawker was coming from.
So the reaction to the story, and again, I don't know if we have to legislate every aspect of this story itself, but it's probably worth discussing it just because no one can see it. So, right. But we'll get to that part. The reaction to it, I'm so sleepy about this stuff that I kind of, I've two small children, so I saw a little brief of it before I went to bed, and I was like, yeah, there's another Gawker blow up. These things happen every couple of weeks, and I didn't really think much about it. Did you edit it? And then you were on a plane. What exactly were the details of, like, Friday morning? When did you know that something was blowing up with that story?
Well, that night there was a media party at Nick Denton's, actually, and the story went up, I think, while we were there. And it was pretty clear right away from the reaction on Twitter that this wasn't going over well. But that happens. That happens a lot. It happens with totally innocuous stories sometimes. It happens as a matter of routine at Gawker. So that we didn't. I don't think it registered right away that this was going to be sort of the mother of all blowups. And then over the course of the evening, things just got worse. I actually went around at one point, and like Gawker people were checking Twitter, and I went around and deleted Twitter off several phones, just because this you know,
right.
It's just a terrible, it's a terrible idea to just immerse yourself in the shitstorm like that, and so. And having been through a number of those, I know, like, I thought, okay, this will pass by the morning. I woke up on Friday, and it had not passed. It had gotten worse.
Now, had anything made it gotten worse, or is it just naturally people were waking up, and then you're seeing the Times guy or the New Yorker guy tweeting about it?
Well, so I think there were – now, keep in mind, I stayed off Twitter. Right. When things really went to hell and gone, I deleted Twitter entirely. So this is based on sort of a reconstruction and based on conversations with people. My sense of it was that there were two stages to the reaction. There was the initial sort of tisking from fellow media and former Gawker people like Corey, Sika. And that's... that is certainly par for the course with Gawker. The what happened here that made it different from any other blow up was that it hit a second stage. And I think, you know, there was an element to it where I think, you know, the Gamer Gators saw Gawker.
Yeah, it was on the heels of that, not the immediate heels, but certainly that wound was still pretty raw.
Yeah, and one thing that Gawker is now has to reckon with is that any criticism will be amplified tenfold, a hundredfold by this set of you know, gibbering opportunistic masturbators known as Gamergate, and I think they sensed Gawker was vulnerable here, and began to lay siege to Gawker's advertisers, which is that has been their tactic, and they're very good at it. I think they figured out sort of the key vulnerability to any online media company. You know, and this is something I've talked about in another forum, but you know, they're sort of the genius, if you can call it that, of the Gamer Gators, is that they realize that a media company sits at the end of a long chain of anxieties. And so if you start working those anxieties, you can cause serious damage to a media company. So, you know, what I'm saying, what I mean specifically is that you have your own internal anxieties, about sort of your the business of Gawker, and then you have the head of advertising's concerns and his concerns about the you know, sort of the anxieties of the CMO he works with or the people at the agency he works with who are concerned about the brand they're working with and how they're going to respond to a specific story or an incident. And the brand has the CFO, CFO's concerns and the CEO's concerns. And
so I feel like I should ask now at this point, because did it worry you? Because you guys, you went through Gamergate, the Gamergate specific Gawker and Biddle's tweet and all that business. And everyone can look that up if they want to. But you'd been seen this targeting of the ad department before. Did that, knowing working for Gawker and knowing how the company worked and knowing kind of the maxim and your mandate put down as editorial director, did that worry you when they did that?
It worried me insofar as I knew it would mean I would have to deal with sort of internal strife. Right. Initially, that was my concern because we had been through this in November of last year. And I thought I guess there were a lot of disagreements on sort of the moral of the story. The last time this went around, I thought it was pretty clear that there was only so much we could do to fight off the you know, gibbering, masturbating opportunists.
Yes.
And that it was going to happen regardless of the merits of the story, regardless of the merits of the criticism. It was going to happen again at some point. So I knew I was in for a fight. I thought it was going to be an internal one. I remember that Friday morning I was making calls to people sort of within the company who were offended by the story. And I was trying to sort of unjangle their nerves.
And to review, you had a flight on Friday, correct? You had a previously scheduled flight from New York to San Francisco?
Right, yeah.
What time was the flight?
It was like 9 in the morning.
Oh, so this is very early on Friday morning.
This is very early. And Nick Denton tried to get me to cancel the flight and stay to manage sort of manage what was clearly becoming a crisis. And I should say that I guess we should sort of lay this out for people. At the time, there was a managing partnership of six people, and that included me as executive editor, Nick Denton as CEO, I think, and publisher. Heather Dietrich, who is the president. Andrew Gorenstein, who's the head of sales. Aaron Pettigrew, who's the head of strategy. And Scott Kidder, who is the chief operating officer. Did I get everyone there?
As far as I remember that, that's all. I don't understand how you guys even had a receptionist there. It's a different place. Yeah, right. So I don't know how any of it works. So sure, I'll take your word for it.
And the idea was that major decisions for the company would be decided by this managing partnership. You know, decisions about the direction of the company, things like that. Nothing had really been put to the test. There were no, I can't think of any formal votes that were actually taken. It operated according to a very just soft consensus.
And there really hadn't been any major issues other than maybe Gamergate, and that had been handled reasonably well. Without getting into every detail of that. Well enough that you felt comfortable getting on that flight.
Yeah. And within the managing partnership, Scott Kidder in particular was very upset about the story. He is, like I said, the chief operating officer, and he's no longer there. And he was texting. There was a group text thread with the managing partners, and he was texting incessantly and angrily about the story throughout the night. And I blew up at one point. This probably wasn't my most diplomatic moment, but it was just at some point I just said, if you want my fucking job, take it, which was probably the wrong thing to say given what turned out, what actually happened. I got on the flight with things sort of blowing up around me. And by the time I got to the airport, it was clear. It was clear that this was something, this had metastasized into something huge. I think at that point, I was talking with some of the other editors about writing a note. The thought of even pulling the post didn't even enter my mind. That is, you know, at a company like Gawker, that is an unprecedented thing to do.
And if I may interject on this, because to me, I will say whatever my thoughts about the post or not thoughts about the post, that was, as someone that, you know, was with Gawker and from the very, very early days, that was the most... That's something that has just simply never been done, other than unless it was legally mandated by the courts.
Right. And in fact, earlier in the year, we had done a couple posts criticizing BuzzFeed for pulling stories because of pressure from the sales side.
Yeah. And my connection with Gawker is very flimsy, to say the least, and has been for a long time. But certainly, you know, you've seen the company change. You've seen things go one way or the other, and different attitudes and different things going on. But the idea of pulling a post, I have to say, when that, and we'll get to the actual details of that happening, but when that happened, that actually, like, I called AJ. And, like, you know, AJ don't, like, listen, AJ had been gone from Gawker. AJ Delorio had been gone from Gawker for a while. But, you know, we were both vets. That shocked. That was a stunning thing that I think that people outside of media and outside of Gawker, there was like, well, just take it down. And, like, that was a shocking thing, I will say.
Yeah.
That was a shocking
thing. And I guess it bears repeating here that the story was true. That is probably the most important thing here. The story was absolutely true. The question was over its news value, over what it actually accomplished. But the facts of the story were, as far as I know, Geithner's lawyer has said that there are things that were incorrect, but hasn't specified. The story was, as far as I know, the story was true.
So you're at the airport. Are you about? Do you get on the plane? I'm assuming you have wireless on the plane. This is another Justine Sacco moment. You're still corresponding while this is going on.
Yeah, I'm mostly communicating with the president and general counsel Heather Dietrich. Nick, at this point, when I told him I couldn't cancel my flight, and I don't know if this is worth mentioning here, but I was flying out to see my pregnant ex-girlfriend who was carrying my daughter, carrying our daughter.
Who has since been born and is very lovely.
Who, yes, Nora is her name. And so this was an important visit that I couldn't miss. It turned out she was born 2 days after I ended up resigning from Gawker. So this was less than a week before she was born. So this was I was not canceling this. I was getting on the plane, and at that point I proposed a statement that was the closest I'll ever get to apologizing for a story that's true. And the upshot of it was essentially, you know, I think the New York Times may have printed this, but the upshot was that according to the standards established by Gawker, you know, a decade ago, more than a decade ago, this was absolutely a story. But given the criticism that we'd received from people whose opinions we trust, this is the sort of story we're going to have to rethink going forward. And that the virtue of that statement was that is absolutely true. There is a cost benefit to every story you run, every big story, even the true ones. Is this going to be worth the shitstorm it could potentially cause? And what we were realizing that morning, what I was realizing, was that the cost was just too great to proceed as blithely as we once did with those kinds of stories.
Is that a difference in the company, or is that a difference in that particular story?
I think it's a difference. I wouldn't even say it's that particular story. I think it's a difference in the audience.
Okay.
And how stories are received, the way the value of stories is now perceived. You know, we're now in this place, where a story's value lies in how well it reflects on the person sharing that story over social media, and sort of how much social capital somebody can accrue in sharing that story. And that changes the dynamic, that changes the calculus tremendously. This is partly why you're seeing an explosion of relentless, almost sociopathic positivity in online journalism, like BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed is the supreme example of a company that kind of realized the lay of the land, realized that positivity is what works on the internet, that positivity is what gets shared. And this is a funny thing, actually. You know, a Deadspin, anytime Drew would rant about the Cardinals or whatever, people would accuse us of, ginning up traffic off, clickbait outrage or whatever. And the funny thing is, outrage doesn't play. Outrage doesn't do monster traffic. It's sunny positivity. It's like, that's the stuff that gets, maiden aunts on Facebook passing your stuff around. So that's the environment Gawker Media is in. Gawker Media was built, I don't want to say in opposition to it because this didn't really exist, but Gawker Media was not built in a way to handle that kind of shift in the landscape. That's not the kind of work I got into journalism. I like my journalism to make me feel bad about the world.
you don't need your journalism for that. I just, as your friend, I just feel like I should oblige you to remind you of that. You don't need journalism to make you feel bad about the world. But, for worth noting, one of the things I thought when all this was going on, I want to wrap up the details on how it went down. But one of the things I thought that was interesting was going on is, on one hand, I totally understood. And I got it, and I understood your frustration with Gawker. And again, we haven't gone to the official part of the story where they take it down. On the other hand, do you feel then and as and I guess now that Gawker, on a lot of ways, Gawker still like they may have made adjustments toward the BuzzFeed way. Maybe this story is one of those examples of them adjusting their attitudes. But this is still a place where is still more in opposition to things than a lot of other places are. Like if you may have found that you didn't have the ultimate freedom at Gawker, but an argument could be made that you still had more freedom there than most places where you might peddle your wares.
That's certainly true. And that was sort of the horseshit of Nick Denton's whole 20% nicer campaign.
Right, right.
And he knew it was horseshit. And the New York Times reporters he said it to knew it was horseshit, but you know, for whatever reason, passed it along straight facedly. Anyway, you know, Gawker is still Gawker more or less. But there are differences. There are differences now. You know, and I think, I mean, maybe we should get to this after,
we finish the TikTok.
Yeah. You know, what happened there was, you know, the horses are out of the barn and across the pastures now, you know, once you pull a post, because, you know, once you give the head of sales power, a vote in the question of whether to pull a post, you change something fundamental about the nature of your company, especially when you have for years prided yourself on the idea that this is a thing you just didn't do. You stuck up for what you published. You know, if you got something wrong, you corrected it transparently. You left it up on the internet for all to see. You wore it like a hair shirt. That had tremendous value that appealed to me. That was why I wanted to work there. That's why I thought this was a place to do the kind of work I wanted to do. And it wasn't just about the license. That the license to say whatever, the license to say mean things. That wasn't just it. It was also about this idea that you were allowed to screw up a little. And you were allowed to test boundaries, and that Gawker would be open about this, about sort of you know, what journalism is, that there are missteps, there's an occasional coarseness, a regrettable coarseness to it, but you didn't run away from that. That you left it up for all to see. And there are stories I regret that I've written, stories that I published at Deadspin that I regret, that I wish I had another crack at, that are there for all the world to see and to criticize us, you know, to hang around our necks, you know, for all eternity. And I think that is a tremendously healthy impulse for a media company, and it's a rare one. You know, there's... Everybody knows, you know, the New York Times corrects a mistake, it's generally buried on page two. They whisper their corrections. Gawker, you know, one of the worst things I published was a Deadspin, was a story that turned out to be wrong about a Senate candidate, Cory Gardner, you know, and I wrote a post that probably did better than the original story in terms of traffic, saying, you know, how Deadspin fucked up. And I think...
You publicly, you know, ate shit.
Publicly ate shit. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, Gawker doesn't have a lot of sort of obvious virtues to people not in journalism, but I feel like this is one of them, that you eat your shit, you wear your hair shirts, that all that stuff. And there aren't many media companies. There really aren't any online media companies who can say that now. And now Gawker can't really say that.
All right. So you're on the plane. When does it? When do you learn that the post is coming down?
So I'm on the plane, and Heather Dietrich tells me that Nick is now talking about pulling the post. And I kind of flip out.
I feel bad for who was sitting next to you. Was it a stranger? Some poor person must have thought you were having a seizure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't mind admitting that I was on tears on the plane. I mean, I was just sobbing huge, stupid tears on the plane when this all went down. And I felt totally powerless to do anything. I felt like the people who needed me there, I had abandoned. It was the most helpless feeling I've had, in journalism, really just period. It became clear that Nick wanted to put it to a vote among the managing partners. And this is the important thing. This is something that Nick has lied about in the aftermath. Nick he talks about it now as if this were a unilateral decision and the vote was just, more Nick seeking counsel from the important figures in the company. That is total horseshit. This was a vote. This was presented to me as a vote. Not once did Nick say that he was going to pull rank here and as publisher make this decision unilaterally. This was presented to me as a vote of the managing partners. I sent an email to the managing partners pleading with them not to pull the post. I thought my statement, I thought my statement was the right way to go. And I was happy to eat whatever shit needed to be eaten. But pulling the post, as I told the managing partners, we become BuzzFeed. That this was a step too far. There was never a point where anybody actually took my vote formally. It was just sort of understood that I was sticking up for the post, or sticking up, or voting to keep the post up.
That would have been a nice heel turn, by the way, to just suddenly be like, actually, I'm voting against it. it's the long con.
I said in an email, I said in that email to the managing partners that I would have to quit if they voted to do this. And at that point, I honestly thought, I didn't think they were going to do it.
Yeah. So that was on an empty promise. It was also one you didn't think you were going to have to keep.
I mean, I thought at least there would be some sort of debate. I had not heard from anybody else besides Heather Dietrich. I hadn't heard from Nick. Nick, at no point in there did he even engage me in an argument on the merits of taking down the post. Nobody made the case to me that we would save money by taking down the post. I mean, and I might be totally wrong here. Again, nobody has actually made the case to me, but the way these brands work, they see a disruption in the corner, the corner of their field of vision. They have advertisements on this website called Gawker, and a lot of people on the internet seem to be mad about Gawker. Their calculus there, they're not reading the story and weighing the ethical issues in play. They see the disruption, see the name Gawker, and just say, we're taking our ads down. I don't think, certainly pulling the story wasn't going to make people any less angry. I feel like pulling the story came from the impulse on Nick's part and on certainly the head of sales, Andrew Gorenstein, their impulse to do something. And my statement wasn't enough. I would love to know if the company actually saved money by pulling the post.
So the vote, when do you find out about the vote?
So the vote happens and Heather says, yeah, okay.
You're still on the plane.
Still on the plane. Post is coming down, and so I say,
I guess I have to quit.
The way John Cook, who is now the executive editor, characterizes me tying a rock to my dick and throwing the rock off. Emma Carmichael, who's the editor of Jezebel, she I think more accurately characterizes it as me tying a rock to my dick and then me jumping off. And horribly mangling my penis.
Yes, I gathered that part.
Yes. So, by the time I landed, I hadn't officially lost the job, or given up the job, but the process had begun.
So how long were you there until you came back?
Originally I was going to take a few days. I was going to take a few days and go to LA, the next week. But I canceled that obviously and came back on Sunday, took a red eye Sunday, got back to the office or got back to New York, early Monday morning. Had breakfast with nine other editors or eight other editors.
I saw the receipt.
Yeah. Which Elizabeth Spires referred to as low grade embezzlement or something. Frankly, is one of the handful of things that still really pisses me off.
I'm gathering.
Yeah. I mean, this was, it was the fuck you there wasn't the amount of the breakfast, which for nine people at Balthazar is actually a rather small amount. The fuck you there was the fact that it was at Balthazar at all, which is Nick Denton's favorite, unfathomably his favorite restaurant.
So then
I addressed the editorial staff and told them, explained why I was quitting, had a very emotional meeting, and that was that.
And then became a father 3 days later, 4 days later,
five, 2 days later,
2 days later.
Baby was 2 weeks early.
It's an active week. So a couple things. There is a school of thought that says, you know, this is newsflash, editorial employee, director or not, discovers that when business interests in his company do not jive with a particular, like, you know, this happens to companies everywhere. The idea that, like, this, they made an equation, and whether you're like, I think there's an argument, I think you're probably right that they probably did not save any money with this particular post. I don't know. We're not in there, but this is not that uncommon of occurrence. I think I saw in some of the initial reaction to this that the two reactions I saw specifically toward you in this were A, why is Tommy surprised? This is how this shit works. And B, more prominently, why is this the hill that he's dying on? Now, do you, first off, just flat out, do you regret quitting?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, it was untenable after that.
So that's the question. So that leads me to the next question, which is it untenable personally, or was the company itself a place where you felt you could no longer do your work?
Both.
Okay.
Both.
Do you think the people there now have had to make a compromise to remain there? Do you think in the back of their mind they know, oh, well, we just have to hope that people don't get really mad at this story on Twitter because we now know what this company is capable of? Or do you think they're like, wow, Tommy took an outstanding stand in this specific story that he should not have taken a stand on?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask them.
Okay. I have them all right here. No, I don't.
I don't know.
Does a media company exist that would have, like, honestly, like, is there a media company out there that wouldn't have taken the post down?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think. I mean, that's a tough question to answer because I don't know how many media companies would have done the story.
Right.
But, you know, actually, honestly, I should take that back because that story is perfectly intelligible as, you know, as part of a genre of, like, of tabloid story. It's not hard to see that story running in the New York Daily News, more or less verbatim, you know? God put Gawker on this earth to catch the CFO of Condé Nast trying to bang hookers, you know, and it's not hard to see that running in any other kind of tabloid.
Okay, I don't mean necessarily the story itself. I mean the reaction. Would other people have weathered that reaction? Like, do you think Gawker did a particularly unusually poor job of reacting to the story, or do you think a lot of people would have done it that way?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, the bad part here, and I think this was something that was misunderstood, was that the head of sales had a vote. The head of strategy, the chief of strategy or whatever, had a vote in an editorial decision. And if they wanted to fire me, you know, if they thought that I had gone beyond the pale here and that I exercised bad editorial judgment, that would have been one thing. To have overstepped their bounds and you know, for the sales side to reach across the wall and to pull a story or to vote to pull a story, to me is you know, it's unconscionable. It's unconscionable, period. It's unconscionable at a place like Gawker. And beyond that, again, this is a company of bomb throwers, of proud bomb throwers, and you can't start hiding the evidence when one of the bombs goes astray. I feel like that that changes something in the company. If you pride yourself on being fearless, and all of a sudden when you know something goes sideways on you, you hide it so nobody can see it. I think you've changed what kind of company you are.
Go ahead.
Well, and just this business about having chosen the wrong hill to die on. There are a couple of things that really infuriate me about that, and it's not just this sort of smarmy armchair careerism. It's the whole point of a principal is that you don't get to choose the hill. Like, the hill chooses you. And Gawker, I think, to its credit, doesn't or didn't have many principals, was gleefully unprincipled. But this was one of them, and this was a bedrock one. And that's, you can't say that anymore. And that's not the Gawker I thought I was working for. It's not the Gawker I wanted to work for. Gawker means a lot of things to different people who work there. And you know, I think the people who are still there who got into it for the same reasons I did, I think they're finding it difficult to negotiate sort of this new landscape there. And I think a lot of the fun has gone out of it, just based on conversations with people there.
Is there a place that's closer to the way, like, did Gawker occupy that place solely before this story happened? That place that you would work for and that place that would stand up for those principles. Are there places out there now that are independent? Like, was Gawker the only one and now there's none left? Or are there other places that you look at and be like, okay, they're doing – they're still holding true? Or is this so pervasive industry-wide that you can't get around it?
I don't know. I mean, I guess the fact that I'm still looking for a job sort of answers that question a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to answer that. I really – I don't know if that's true. I want to believe it's not for the sake of – my career, but who knows? And yeah, I don't know how to answer that.
Do you read Gawker now? Do you read any Gawker sites?
I will read stories when they sort of bubble up to the surface on my Twitter feed or Facebook or whatever. I've read, you know, and of course, like any big Deadspin scoop, I can't. I wouldn't want to miss, but it's too painful for me to read regularly.
One of the things that I think gets lost a little bit sometimes too, you know, is, you know, I thought it was strange. It reminded me a little bit of when we did your roast at Deadspin, and it was very funny because, you know, when I left Deadspin, everyone knew Will Leach is the guy that runs the site. When AJ left Deadspin, AJ's the guy that runs the site. When you did your roast, there were a lot of like, hey, who is this guy that they're talking about who's not Drew? Or, you know, like there's a certain like not understanding how much of an editorial influence and how much editorial power and how many kind of like proteges you actually have around. Like Deadspin is no longer a personality individual as much as Deadspin probably more than others. But certainly, you know, it was amusing to do the roast and have a bunch of people being like, wait, who is Tommy Craggs? And we're like, this is the guy that's actually making all of this stuff. So so what's interesting to me is I see people like Greg Howard, like people that you've worked with, like Emma, like people that you have worked with for a long time and are still prominent in this world in at Gawker and frankly at other places. You know, there are, I know you're friends with Brian Curtis and all of these other people that you've worked with, both worked with and have worked for you. How often do you guys talk about this? Do they, I mean, I know that you are still on the hunt, as you say, which is baffling to me, but we won't get into that. Do you, like, I don't know, when you, what's your relationship with all those guys still? Like, with all the people that you kind of have mentored and kind of worked through the business that, like, at a certain level, there was a lot of, you know, Albert wrote a great thing on Deadspin, you know, talking about how the importance of you as an editor, importance of all this stuff, you know, and Manti Te'o doesn't have it without you and so on. Do you sense, like, I don't know, when you talk to those guys, do you feel, do they check in with you? Like, I guess that's the question is, you know, I remember I was on a panel with Greg and Elena Bergeron from SB Nation at Syracuse. And, you know, the three of us just sat and shared Tommy Craig stories for an hour and a half as if we were talking about Kaplan. And also because you're both weird. But, you know, being on the outside, are you antsy? Never minding whatever personal fears that you may have going on, but are you like, how are you itching?
Yeah. I mean, I tried to break myself of this habit early on, but I still find myself sending story ideas to writers and editors at Gawker. As much as I want to, I can't turn off that part of my brain. As angry as I am with the company, I want all of those guys to succeed. I don't know. I'm itching. You know, I didn't accomplish a fraction of the stuff I wanted to do as executive editor. I knew my time was going to be limited. I knew that, I probably had a year. And I thought there was a lot I could do in that year. I had things I wanted to do. That was cut short. I've got the itch.
Do you have an itch to write? Do you want to get back into editing? Are you looking to write? Or does it matter?
At this point, it doesn't really matter. My situation with my family, leads me to want something sort of relatively stable, relatively quiet. I guess the ideal would be an editing job where I could write on the side. I guess the big thing, and this is maybe the impossible dream, is that I want to get off internet time. And that I'm absolutely tired of working on internet time. And this is a luxury that there probably aren't many jobs like that out there anymore.
Yeah. I'm totally walking between the raindrops myself on that one, like without question. But do you, I mean, when you look at, do you want to be in San Francisco? You staying in San Francisco?
Yeah, I'll probably, I'm in the process of sort of the slow motion relocation to California.
So do you, what did you think of the Grantland stuff, by the way, of how that went down?
Well, which part of it?
How it ended. The Simmons part leaving, and then how, I guess the argument is once Simmons gone, that was inevitably going to happen. But, you know, just the way the whole thing went down, like as someone that almost worked there, you know, do you regret not taking that job? I guess you'd be unemployed either way. Though I guess you would still be able to get in free to Disneyland for the next 2 or 3 days. Right. So, but are you, like, what did you, you saw a lot of people saying in the wake of the Grantland thing, you know, the thing that worries me about the wake of the Grantland thing is everyone spent like a week being like, I can't believe Grantland is gone. Every job, what is happening to this world? And then everyone went back to sharing Stephen A. Smith's clips in a lot of ways. Do you think that there was – do you think Grantland's was just because of Simmons? Do you think that can still work? And just what do you think of how all that went down?
Well, I guess I've always been sort of cranky about Grantland. This predates, contrary to what Jay Mariotti has said, this had nothing to do with bitterness over.
Contrary to what Jay Mariotti has said, literally whatever words might happen to come next. But yes, go ahead.
One of the things that became clear in all the caterwauling and garment rending over Grantland's demise was just how much Grantland was this sort of mechanism for people to feel superior to other people and to other things on the internet. Grantland ran a lot of great stuff, employed some of my favorite writers, writers who, I think it's important to note, would have been employed elsewhere and doing the same sort of stories. I mean, I can think of a handful of stories that could only have happened at a place with resources and license to do whatever the fuck. A handful of stories, Brian Phillips on the sumo wrestlers, that sort of thing. Those were few and far between. I mean, Zach Lowe was writing brilliant things when he was just a Celtics blogger. He was doing the same sort of stuff. He didn't have quite the, the power he does now, but he was, Zach Lowe didn't come out of nowhere. He was doing this stuff for Sports Illustrated. Brian Curtis didn't come out of nowhere. He was writing the same sort of smart media criticism for Play and Slate before that. Charlie Pierce obviously didn't come out of nowhere. So what Grantland did was they put them all under one roof. Where I think it failed as a website, it was a lot of different pieces that weren't really talking to one another. Sort of the entertainment side and the sports side, I besides sort of the whims of Bill Simmons, I didn't really see what connected those two things. And that's a tall order to sort of wed those two elements. But the component parts were by and large really good. It's just that Grantland wasn't, you could find those things in plenty of places, and you could before Grantland existed. Grantland paid those writers well, and that's the thing that will be missed, is that Grantland paid good money to good writers.
Those writers will all still be doing it wherever they end up, and if they're not all still already doing it already.
Yeah.
And it is amazing. Like, it took me like two Zach Lowe columns to be like, okay, he's on ESPN now.
Right, right.
it took me two Barnwell columns to do the same thing.
In a lot of ways, Zach Lowe makes more sense on ESPN. Mm-hmm. That's real nitty gritty basketball stuff for hoops junkies, and that's Bill Simmons. But the website he created had these aspirations of literary high mindedness. So even within the sports side, you had this kind of granular look at basketball transactions and basketball plays and that sort of thing. And then you had had Brian Phillips going to the Iditarod, and even those two things don't they seem a little weird sitting next to each other. I felt bad for my friends there, and I felt bad for the people who sort of Bill Simmons fucked over in the course of saying fuck you to ESPN. I don't know. They're all doing great work elsewhere now. I don't know.
I always want to ask you this every time I talk to you on a podcast or not. Give me a college story about Rovell.
what was the last one I told?
I don't know. Told me a story off air. I'm actually not going to remind you in case that's the one that's the first comes to your mind. Give me your favorite Rovell in college story.
Okay. I may have I may be conflating a couple stories here. This may not be. Well, who cares if this is accurate?
Print the legend. Come on, Greg.
So the Darren Rebell was he did the college radio WNUR, which covered
at Northwestern.
Northwestern.
Yes, we're classmates at Northwestern.
Yeah, he actually would wear purple blazers to games, which you know, it was a very unflattering purple blazer. And at one point, I don't remember if this was Rebell or somebody else at WNBR, but let's just, for the sake of the story, let's pretend
it was him. It was him. Rebell. It was him. I'm going to edit that last rejoinder out.
Okay. He was, they were doing a baseball game, and, you know, when it's college radio, you're doing this basically for an audience of zero. This is for yourself or, you know, tapes that you end up sending to prospective employers, that sort of thing. But they would do trivia, in-game trivia. And I guess nobody would ever call in with the answers. But one game, my friend, who is Jeff Carlton, who is the baseball beat writer, he was sitting at the other end of the press box. He hears them go into their trivia bit. And he decides to call in from just like 10 feet away, and he watches them get really excited. And, you know, somebody's actually listening. Somebody's actually calling in. And I don't remember what the trivia question was, but he answered correctly, of course, and they were thrilled. They thought they had, you know, they had reached an audience at this point. And it was just my friend sitting, you know, 5 feet away.
Was this a common thing to, because when I've talked to you about Rebell in the past, there's been a lot
to fuck with Darren Rebell?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, back then he was harmless. He was just sort of this harmless doofus, and even likable in his way. He was a haircut, it was fun to sort of make fun of, and you could feel like you were, you know, he was doing this pretend journalism, but, you know, we were writers for the student paper, the August Daily Northwestern. We were doing the serious journalism. And then, he is now this incredible force for evil and stupid. And I wish we had bullied him a little harder.
Yeah, listen, I'm just saying, you know, I mean, I think our presidential candidates have commented on whether or not they would go back in time, and you actually had the opportunity, Cracks. And what did you do with it? You just harmlessly goofed. All right, well, Tommy, I'm glad we did this. I look forward to next year's conversation. When we talk about how the first 9 or 10 months working for Bill Simmons at HBO has been.
I'll tell you about the soup kitchens I'm hanging out in.
But Tommy, it is always an honor to do this. And I'd like to thank you. I have just on a personal note, I had my 40th birthday this year. I turned 40 with a bullet. And I had some friends come out, and Tommy, I did not know that you were going to come out, and you came out, and I'm proud to say I can't think of a better way to spend my 40th birthday than drinking with you and screaming at an Illinois losing football game.
Anytime.
Yeah, that was a very enjoyable thing. All right, Tommy. Well, everyone, follow Tommy. I love that you're back on. You're not on Twitter as much, but like there are rumblings. I liked a couple weeks ago. I saw Tommy Craig's follows 226 people. And I was like, all right, here comes Craig's. So you can follow Tommy at TCRAGGS22. That's right. There's an extra C in there. There's an extra C in there. And hey, happy New Year, man.
You too. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. And we'll see. I'm curious. We'll do this again next year when we talk. Or maybe it'll be you. Maybe they'll be Fox Sports 1. We'll have a former Deadspin editor show with you and Clay Travis. That would be fun. You know, it's funny. Clay Travis was on with Dave Zirin was on Fox Sports 1. With Clay Travis, and I love Dave, you know, and you know Dave, and you know we disagree with Dave sometimes, but I think generally, you know, I think he's one of the good guys. But I actually got mad at him for going on with Clay. And I've gone on with Clay in the past when I was on this show, but like, I'm not, you know, Dave. But there was something about like, don't, you're just like, it's, you know, it's the idea of, you know, putting, you know, the way that an MSNBC show or a Fox News show will have like the token, right. Like, you know, Fox News will have Al Hunt right. Hang on there or something. You know, it felt like, come on.
Yeah, it's legitimizing the moron.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, so I just hope to see that show. I think it would be very enjoyable.
Right, yeah.
I just think it would be fun. But anyway, free Katie Nolan. All right. Thank you, Tommy. Thank you for playing around with me. Have a wonderful new year, and we'll do this again next year.
Okay.
All right. Be safe, everyone. Everyone have a wonderful new year. Thank you for listening to me and Tommy Chet. I hope you enjoy. Of course, please rate and review us on iTunes. The music, of course, is by the Sundogs. We'll be back after the new year. I'll probably be talking with Allison about baseball, and maybe I'll talk to I'll talk to Clay about maybe get that Tommy Craig's show put together. All right. Be safe. Have a wonderful new year, everyone. Enjoy spending your New Year's watching college football, apparently. That's just what we do now. So be safe. Take care. Happy New Year.